Okay, so we're chapter 4, The Divine and the Undivine, and the paragraph begins, when we say that all is a divine manifestation. And I'm not sure what page that is. Does somebody have the page?
It's on the PDF, it's on page 407, the paragraph starting when we say that all is a divine manifestation.
Right, okay, so page 407. And as we discussed earlier, Sri Aurobindo is continuing his consideration of the dualities of our experience. and in this particular chapter, as the title says, the duality is that of the divine and the undivine. And what it implies is a certain kind of struggle that we face, all creatures face, and in fact, Sri Aurobindo would say the entire creation faces, right from the material in conscience, through every grade of consciousness, there is a struggle to emerge into greater consciousness and a state of security, endurance, and delight. So this struggle has to be addressed. If there is some reality which is perfect, clearly we are not experiencing that. And so Sri Aurobindo is trying to get to the bottom of what is this imperfection, where we are at this time in the paragraph. We went through a very powerful paragraph last time before the one that we should start now. And in that, he's talking about two kinds of imperfections, that of ignorance and that of falsehood, that exist due to the nature of this creation, in which there is a diminution of consciousness, diminution of power, so that we can see that there is a lack of whatever we feel conscious in. And so these faults, imperfections of ignorance and falsehood, are naturally there because we may try to justify it in terms of our own problems, as has been done in some religions. But ultimately, they have to be accepted as cosmic conditions that have been put there before us. We are only participating in it. And Sri Aurobindo ends that paragraph by pointing out how these problems of ignorance and falsehood are not just surface phenomena due to errors in our consciousness, but things to which we, at some deep level, give our assent, because in some deep level there is a sanction to these things, and that they have been the cause of a certain kind of perverse bliss. So this is where the reasoning has taken us so far. There remains the fact that there is the single being in whose nature we have to account for this imperfection. A single divine manifestation. And if there is imperfection, it is something that we have to be able to account for in terms of this divine manifestation. So with that, we can enter into this new paragraph, and unless anybody has any comments or questions at this point.
Ramon, would you like to start reading?
Okay. When we say that all is a divine manifestation, even that which we call undivine, we mean that in its essentiality, all is divine, even if the form baffles or repels us. Or, to put it in a formula to which it is easier for our psychological sense of things to give its assent, in all things there is a presence, a primal reality, dash, the self, comma, the divine, comma, Brahman, comma, which is forever pure, perfect, blissful, infinite. Its infinity is not affected by the limitations of relative things. Its purity is not stained by our sin and evil. Its bliss is not touched by our pain and suffering. Its perfection is not impaired by our defects of consciousness, knowledge, will, unity. In certain images of the Upanishads, the divine Purusha is described as the one fire, which has entered into all forms and shapes and shapes itself according to the form, as the one sun which illumines all impartially and is not affected by the faults of our seeing. But this affirmation is not enough. It leaves the problem unsolved. Why that which is in itself ever pure, perfect, blissful, infinite, should not only tolerate, but seem to maintain and encourage in its manifestation imperfection and limitation, impurity and suffering and falsehood and evil. It states that the duality that constitutes the problem, but does not solve it.
So in this short paragraph, Sri Aurobindo is summing up the situation that he has introduced in the previous paragraph, which is to say that there is a reality which is perfect and that it somehow has become this reality which is imperfect, is to restate the paradox in other terms. It doesn't really answer the question as to why the imperfection exists. When we ask the question why the imperfection exists and try to give an answer to it, it also means that we have a intuition of perfection, because without that we would have accepted our lot much more easily as the only kind of existence that was possible. But there is a certain question mark to the experience of imperfection, and that in itself poses this paradox, because there must be some ideal state of perfection from which we are, you know, which is absent from our experience. So this is the paradox that we can talk about two realities, but we cannot explain why, even if one is primary, the other is secondary, why should the primary reality have become that kind of secondary reality, which does not represent its truth?
Are you there,
Devendra? Yeah. I don't have anything else to say.
Oh, okay. I can read the next paragraph. If we simply leave these two dissonant facts of existence standing in each other's presence, we are driven to conclude that there is no reconciliation possible. All we can do is to cling as much as we can to a deepening sense of the joy of the pure and essential presence, and do the best we may with the discordant externality, until we can impose in its place the law of its divine contrary. Or else, we have to seek for an escape rather than a solution. For we can say that the inner peace alone is a truth, and the discordant externality is a falsehood or illusion created by a mysterious principle of ignorance. Our problem is to find some way of escape out of the falsehood of the manifested world into the truth of the hidden reality. Or we may hold with the Buddhists that there is no need for explanation, since there is this one practical fact of the imperfection and impermanence of things and no self, divine or Brahman, for that too is an illusion of our consciousness. The one thing that is necessary for liberation is to get rid of the persistent structure of ideas and persistent energy of action which maintain a continuity in the flux of the impermanence. On this road of escape, we achieve self-extinction in Nirvana. The problem of things get itself extinguished by our own self-extinction. This is a way out, but it does not look like the true and only way, nor are the other solutions altogether satisfactory. It is a fact that by excluding the discordant manifestation from our inner consciousness as a superficial externality, by insisting only on the pure and perfect presence, we can achieve individually a deep and blissful sense of this silent divinity, can enter into the sanctuary, can live in the light and the rapture. An exclusive inner concentration on the real, the eternal, is possible, even a self-immersion by which we can lose or put away the dissonances of the universe. But there is too, somewhere, deep down in us, the need of a total consciousness. There is in nature a secret, universal seeking for the whole divine, an impulsion towards some entire awareness and delight and power of existence. This need of a whole being, a total knowledge, this integral will in us is not fully satisfied by these solutions. So long as the world is not divinely explained to us, the divine remains imperfectly known. For the world too is that, and so long as it is not present to our consciousness and possessed by our powers of consciousness in the sense of the divine being, we are not in possession of the whole divinity.
So, here Sri Aurobindo continues to pose the problem, because he says that the problem does not go away if we just pose it as an empirical reality. We have these experiences, and it is possible to get away from these experiences with or without explanation. So, either we posit some kind of duality, a state where one the imperfect condition remains imperfect, and we get out of it into the perfect condition, or we posit it as part of a monism, where there is only one reality, but some kind of screen or appearance where some mysterious force has put up a kind of hodgepodge dream in which we find ourselves. And there too, the injunction would be to get out of it and into the perfection. And the third option is what he points out through Buddhism, where these are structures of perception. And if we can get rid of the wrong perception, then everything vanishes. And there is no need to posit some kind of perfection. If it is there, we realize it after the misperception disappears. But then, as he says, there is something here which does not satisfy the being. And Sri Aurobindo, as we can see in the way in which he reasons throughout this book, makes a double appeal. An appeal on the one hand to our reasoning capacity, and on the other to our intuition. And here he will call on this kind of intuition that refuses to accept the imperfection of the world or of worldly experience as having a divine basis unless we can explain it in divine terms. And that is the point that he's making, that in jumping to the conclusion that our best or only solution is to escape from this imperfection, we are denying the deepest aspiration within ourselves and in the entire so-called imperfect world to be explained in terms of the perfection, in terms of the divine.
So, Devajana.
Yeah.
So, in this, when they say that the Buddhist perception, so what do Buddhism mean by the word perception there? That perception, does it have an object, subject, or that is how do they define perception?
As he's saying, the way he puts it over here is the one thing that is necessary for liberation is to get rid of the persistent structure of ideas and persistent energy of action which maintain a continuity in the flux of the impermanence. So the idea is that there is something like a stream, like a constantly changing stream, like the flux of impermanence, as he calls it there. And within that, there arise certain accidental formations, which are like eddy currents, you may say. And these develop a certain kind of identity. And they, whatever the forces that are giving them their temporary existence, become to them their identity factors. And then those are represented in terms of desires that become a complex, what is called a samskara, or a set of samskaras that are continuing to propel themselves by the fact of their, it's like a machine, a machinic function, automatic function. And so this whole complex of automatic functions is what is driving that formation and keeping it in existence from life to life. This is what they mean by it. And so misperception is to believe that that has some reality. If you can get rid of that, and how do you get rid of that? He's saying get rid of the desires, break the backbone of desiring, and the whole flux collapses.
Debashish, in this paragraph he talks about integral will.
Which is that sentence, Margaret?
Let me see. Yes, it says, an impulsion towards some entire awareness and delight and power of existence, this need of a whole being, a total knowledge, this integral will in us. Has he spoken or explained what an integral will is in the previous?
No, he has not. He has not. Okay. See, this is one of those examples where that appeal to the intuition is being made by him over here. He's saying that what it means is that there is an integral aspiration, there is an integral truth, and so there is something in us which is the integral will that has not been achieved because it is faced with imperfection, and that exactly is why we aspire for the perfection.
Thank you.
Margaret, would you like to read next?
I'm sorry, Sean, who did you ask?
Margaret, you.
Oh, sorry. Yes. It is possible to escape from the problem otherwise. For admitting always the essential presence, we can endeavor to justify the divinity of manifestation by correcting the human view of perfection, or putting it aside as a too limited mental standard. We may say that not only is the spirit in things absolutely perfect and divine, but each thing also is relatively perfect and divine in itself, in its expression of what it has to express of the possibilities of existence, in its assumption of its proper place in the complete manifestation. Each thing is divine in itself because each is a fact and idea of the divine being, knowledge, and will, fulfilling itself infallibly in accordance with the law of that particular manifestation. Each being is possessed of the knowledge, the force, the measure and kind of delight of existence, precisely proper to its own nature. Each works in the gradations of experience decreed by a secret inherent will, a native law, an intrinsic power of the self, an occult significance. It is thus perfect in the relation of phenomena to the law of its being, for all are in harmony with that, spring out of it, adapt themselves to its purpose according to the infallibility of the divine will and knowledge at work within the creature. It is perfect and divine also in relation to the whole, in its proper place in the whole. To that totality it is necessary, and in it it fulfills a part by which the perfection, actual and progressive, of the universal harmony, the adaptation of all in it to its whole purpose and its whole sense, is helped and completed. If to us things appear undivine, if we hasten to condemn this or that phenomenon as inconsistent with the nature of a divine being, it is because we are ignorant of the sense and purpose of the divine in the world in its entirety. Because we see only parts and fragments, we judge of each by itself as if it were the whole. Judge also the external phenomena without knowing their secret sense. But by doing so, we vitiate our valuation of things, put on it the stamp of an initial fundamental error. Perfection cannot reside in the thing in its separateness, for that separateness is an illusion. Perfection is the perfection of the total divine harmony.
So here he's trying to say that there are other ways by which we can explain away this problem. And if we look at the subtext of this paragraph that was just read, we see that one way we can do that is to ignore or deny the truth of the individual. In other words, if we say that the cosmos is perfect as a total, as a whole, then we can think of a type of an ecosystem in which everything plays its part. So it's an orchestration of perhaps individual limitations, but that add up to a perfect whole. And that would mean that whatever imperfection we experience in ourselves as individuals is something that is a personal ignorance or a personal problem. But it doesn't really exist as far as the totality is concerned. So if we shift our perception to the harmony of, limitations, then we will find that everything is perfect. And whatever imperfection we experience is just due to the relationship between these limited expressions. So this kind of argument also, in a way, wishes away the experience of imperfection and pins it to a misperception, that it is really a change of perception and things will be okay. I mean, we'll be able to reconcile our existence with this state of things.
Actually, this imperfection that you are just referring to, I mean, even though it appears to be, even if it can be argued that everything is in place, etc. So this imperfection, is it a physical imperfection or is it something that we are unable to perceive as a whole?
No, it's not only physical, it's also psychological, but it is, the imperfection is being so called because, as he said, that there are two properties to it. One is ignorance and the other is falsehood. So if we look at it from the individual standpoint, we can see our own actions and the actions of beings around us as being marked by these two kinds of properties. So we feel that why isn't the truth expressing itself? If the truth is the truth of oneness, why not through every contact that we have and in ourselves, we experience everything else as being identical and we can understand everything. There isn't that limitation of understanding that constitutes ignorance. Also, we have the right kind and amount of force to apply in every case so that whatever is required becomes perfectly achieved. So it is the limitation of consciousness, knowledge, and force in the individual and their perverse action as well. In other words, we may have the right force but use it to bring pain and suffering to others or in some way which is not in keeping with the identity of things. So those are the forms of imperfection. They are individually experienced. But if we say that that individual ignorance and individual lack of capacity is a certain kind of a degree that has been coded into each entity so that the totality runs like a clock, you may say. That totality is running perfectly. So then the individual's existence is not significant. What is significant is only the existence of the totality. And we can say that we should not even think about this problem of this imperfection, because that does not exist in the whole. It exists only in some perception of the part.
Thank you.
Devashish, or could we say that in this paragraph he's saying the perception of the individual is put on hold in a temporal sense, put on hold temporarily. I don't know whether he's implying the evolution of perfection here. Yet.
I don't think so. I didn't get the sense of an evolution of imperfection towards perfection here. The sense is more one of entity, a totality that is perfect, but that runs due to a gradation of limited parts that put in relation to each other to form this perfect whole.
So this element of development or evolutionary change is not in here yet?
No, in this paragraph at least, I don't see that hasn't been brought in.
Okay.
Margaret, would you like to read next? Oh, Margaret just read.
Yeah, just read.
Yeah. Yeah. Rika?
Yeah, sure. Is this all this may be true?
Yeah.
All this may be true up to a certain point, and so far as it goes, But this also is a solution incomplete by itself, and it cannot give us an entire satisfaction. It takes insufficient account of the human consciousness
and the human view from which we have to start. It does not give us the vision of the harmony it alleges, and so it cannot meet our demand or convince, but only contradicts by a cold intellectual conception our acute human sense of the reality of evil and imperfection. It gives, too, no lead to the psychic element in our nature, the soul's aspiration towards light and truth and towards a spiritual conquest, a victory over imperfection and evil. By itself, this view of things amounts to little more than the facile dogma which tells us that all that is right, because all is perfectly decreed by the divine wisdom. It supplies us with nothing better than a complacent intellectual and philosophic optimism. No light is turned on the disconcerting facts of pain, suffering, and discord to which our human consciousness bears constant and troubling witness. At most, there is a suggestion that in the divine reason of things, there is a key to these things to which we have no access. This is not a sufficient answer to our discontent and our aspiration, which, however ignorant in their reactions, however mixed their mental motives, must correspond to a divine reality deeper down in our being. A divine whole that is perfect by reason of the imperfection of its parts runs the risk of itself being only perfect in imperfection. Let me read it one more time. A divine whole that is perfect by reason of the imperfection of its parts runs the risk of itself being only perfect in imperfection, because it fulfills entirely some stage in an unaccomplished purpose. It is then a present but not an ultimate totality. To it, we could apply the Greek saying, Theos ok istin alagignetai. I don't know the pronunciation. The divine is not yet in being, but is becoming. The true divine would then be secret within us and perhaps supreme above us. To find the divine within us and above us would be the real solution. To become perfect as that is perfect. To become perfect as that is perfect. To attain liberation by likeness to it, or by attaining to the law of its nature. Sadrishya, sadharmya. Sadrishya, sadharma.
So now we see the element of evolution is being brought in, John Robert, in this paragraph. Because as he starts the paragraph, he points out that what has been missed out in this previous view of the totality of imperfect parts, as he's saying, a perfection of, made up of imperfect parts, it doesn't give any value to the individual as a reality. The part also has its reality, its truth. And if there is an integral truth, that's why he's talking of the integral will in us, the integral truth, every part in it must partake, not only partake, but be the totality. And so there has to be perfection in the parts as well. This is the point he's making. It has to be fully conscious of the totality. If there has been a deliberate reduction in capacity in a certain part, that has to be the choice of the part itself, the part's own reduction, rather than a reduction imposed on a part to make it imperfect so that the totality can be perfect through its sum. So that's the way in which he prefaces or privileges the psychic element in man, as he's saying over here, the aspirant element, not only in man, but in the whole creation. In man, it becomes the psychic being, but the psychic element is the element of aspiration, which is the way by which that which has denied itself is becoming perfect or becoming divine. That's why he turns around and says that the way we have to understand this is through the Greek notion that it's not yet divine, that it is not in being but in becoming. And hence this world is a world in which the time dimension is being explored. It is a temporal world, a world of unfoldment, that is not all to start with present, but unfolding itself through the discontent that he's talking about, the perception of imperfection itself, driving us towards a greater becoming. And so that gives the reality and truth to the imperfection. It's a temporary formation, but it is there so that the aspiration of the part may let it experience the becoming, the temporal dimension, and that it may aspire to become the image of that perfection, which is by likeness, as he says, and by law of nature, that we aspire to become one. It's interesting that Sri Aurobindo draws on the Greek idea of being and becoming over here, because this notion of the becoming also can be mapped to the Platonic notion of the ideas, the perfect archetype, towards which everything is aspiring, and by becoming alike to which, this sadrishya, sadharmya, is possible because that image lives within each of us. Therefore, we can grow into the likeness of that image. This is what he's saying. So the temporal element is what gives us some kind of answer to this paradox, and the individual's place in it is critical, because the paradox hinges on the human aspiration and the ability of the human to overcome the limitations with which it is faced.
I have a question. This becoming thing, I mean, becoming is also equally infinite as being, right?
Yes, that's true. But we may say that the divine is not yet in being but in becoming is highlighting a state of existence in which the becoming is going to arrive at a state where the whole of being is manifest. The dimension of time will not disappear, but the ignorance will disappear. So there will be an infinite becoming, but that becoming also proceeds through stages, and one of those critical stages is the transition from ignorance to knowledge.
Thank you.
Devishish, it seems like in this paragraph, he's really beginning to highlight the element of aspiration. You've mentioned that a couple of times in your commentary. And the aspiration seems like it then becomes a part of the whole cosmic process.
Exactly.
And a necessary part of the cosmic process.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. That's exactly it. And necessary part of the cosmic process for the evolution, because that becomes the very meaning of this imperfection. The imperfection is there so that it may be overcome, and it may be overcome only by the exercise of the aspiration, which will be the participation of the parts in the temporal becoming of the whole.
It seems to me that really turns a different light on evil and ignorance.
Exactly.
It's like it suddenly fits into place.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. That's why he was content with the other solutions that he posed before. And as he says, that there's some kind of lack in a solution which does not give full value to the integrality of things, in which the part must be the whole.
So when he uses, terms like divine within us and above us, within us is something that one can intuitively conceptualize, or even when he says above us, how do you, intuit about it? How do you, how do you conceptualize it to have that aspiration for it?
Well, in both ways. One is literally, because from the viewpoint that there is the source of perfection above our heads in the Sahasrara chakra and beyond.
Mm-hmm.
So one can open to the kind of source above the head, quiet the mind and open to the source above the head, with the call to that perfection to descend into us and perfect us. We don't know what it looks like, but we can call on it all the same. So that is one way. And the other way, philosophically speaking, through the whole cosmic process, the cosmic process is a process of ignorance, which is to say that we can conceive of ourselves as being hidden from that which is beyond, extra cosmic, which is perfect. And so we are calling on something which is beyond the horizon of our expectations. In that sense, it is above us. But what it is, what we have a memory of it, we have a stirring of it. That's why, Plato was to say that all knowledge is really a remembering. So that remembering is what is within us. It is the stirring of the memory which is within us. It's a living memory, a living image, but it is very deep within us, and the source of it is outside. Again, note that we're, in a sense, the metaphors related to this kind of description easily fit the Vedic idea of the sun and the fire in the cave, the earth that goes through its cycles of day and night, the sun, which is above in that sense, or beyond, and the flame in the cave of the heart, which is the psychic element, that is caught in the darkness and must aspire and increase its light with whatever knowledge it has. But in doing that, it is also calling on its own source, which is outside and above, to, you know, come in as the day and release the flame from the night.
Yeah, thank you, Devashisa. The first intuition is, I mean, when you said about, like, you know, physically above the head, the Sahasrahara, that is... one, I mean, I find like easier to meditate on, but the other one, as a metaphor, it's like your second metaphor about the sun. It makes it easier to explain, but I'm not sure if that's. I mean, you, I guess one has to learn how to meditate on that too. Thank you.
So, because one is the first one is an individual experience, and it was always there in the sense that we can talk about. Tantra always having this idea of the Sahasrara, though now we are calling on that to descend into our waking consciousness rather than trying to ascend into it and go into a trance. But the other idea is a cosmic idea, and so it is not just at the individual level, but also there is a call being made to the power which is above our individual head, but which is also cosmic, and which is having its effect on the entire cosmos and its evolution through us. Each individual is also a part of that cosmic movement.
I mean, another thought just came to me is that if we take that notion that the divine alone exists, so our ignorance, everything is like a one small cell in the entire divine, within the entire divine. So what it means is that divine must be enveloping us as well.
Yeah, undoubtedly, yes. Divine is enveloping us as well. So this is, the divine is outside us, the divine is around us, and the divine is within us. But the process through which we are passing makes the perfection unavailable to us, and that's the cause of the discontent that ignites the flame of aspiration, as well as makes us yearn for that which is beyond.
John Robert, would you like to read next?
Yeah, sure. If the human consciousness were bound to the sense of imperfection and the acceptance of it as the law of our life and the very character of our existence, a reasoned acceptance that could answer in our human nature to the blind animal acceptance of the animal nature, then we might say that what we are marks the limit of the divine self-expression in us. We might believe too that our imperfections and sufferings worked for the general harmony and perfection of things, and console ourselves with this philosophic balm offered for our wounds, satisfied to move among the pitfalls of life with as much rational prudence or as much philosophic sagacity and resignation as our incomplete mental wisdom and our impatient vital parts permitted. Or else, taking refuge in the more consoling fervors of religion, we might submit to all as the will of God in the hope or the faith of recompense in a paradise beyond or we shall enter into a happier existence and put on a more pure and perfect nature. But there is an essential factor in our human consciousness and its workings, which no less than the reason distinguishes it entirely from the animal. There is not only a mental part in us which recognizes the imperfection, there is a psychic part which rejects it. Our soul's dissatisfaction with imperfection as a law of life upon earth, its aspiration towards the elimination of all imperfections from our nature, not only in a heaven beyond where it would be automatically impossible to be imperfect, but here and now in a life where perfection has to be conquered by evolution and struggle, are as much a law of our being as that against which they revolt. They too are divine, a divine dissatisfaction, a divine aspiration. In them is the inherent light of a power within which maintains them in us, so that the divine may not only be there as a hidden reality in our spiritual secrecies, but unfold itself in the evolution of nature.
Again, a small but very powerful paragraph. And he starts with two other arguments that he feels now. One is the humanist argument, we may say. The first argument that he feels in this paragraph is close to our modern times. And it is the rational acceptance of imperfection. It is, where we tell ourselves that this is what the human definition is. Human beings are like this, and hence we have to design for these imperfections and accept them as the reality, not expect anything else or different. And then the other scenario that he presents is closer to Islam, where you don't ask any questions about the state of things here. We take it for granted that it is the inscrutable will of God that we can never really know, and we shouldn't even ask that question. We just are beholden to a creator to whom we should prostrate. And if we are, sort of Godward minded throughout our lives, then we will experience that perfection in a heaven beyond. So this is the heaven argument, and there are other religions which also point to perfection as a condition of the afterlife in some heaven, but never here. And so he feels those two arguments as well, and then brings back what he has introduced in the previous paragraph, the power of the soul, of the psychic being. And he says that that is another characteristic that distinguishes the human from the animal. Not that the animal doesn't have any psychic quality in it, but the psychic being which emerges in the human as a operational being within us, with a mentality, vitality, and subtle physicality. And that is, one may say, there are two characteristics, and this is what makes the human being in some sense so different as a creature within nature, that there is a full-blown utilization of the mind, which makes us rational. But there is another feature, and that's the point he's making, the development of the psychic being, which is our true being. That is the true, the essence of the human. When we talk of an age of humanism, this is the truth of humanism, the psychic part. And this psychic part is already in tune with the perfection, and hence it rejects the imperfect. That's the point he's making. This is the source of the struggle that the whole creation finds itself in. And that struggle is because the psychic being is put into contact with an imperfect world so that it may grow in strength and evolve its perfection in this imperfect world.
I like the use of the word philosophic bomb.
Yeah, that entire that sentence and that part of the paragraph is very telling. It's extremely graphic.
Yes, very much.
There's irony even in that the last part of that sentence, as he says over there. We might say that we are what we are marks the limit of the divine self-expression in us. We might believe, too, that our imperfections and sufferings work for the general harmony and perfection of things, and console ourselves with this philosophic balm offered for our wounds, satisfied to move among the pitfalls of life with as much rational prudence or as much philosophic sagacity and resignation as our incomplete mental wisdom and our impatient vital parts permitted.
Yeah, it really seems like there's a subtle,
sarcasm. Yes. That you can convince yourself as much as you want with your philosophic reasonings, but your mind and your vital themselves will, you know, belie your reasoning.
Beautiful.
I'm impressed here again at the role of the psychic being, the aspiration and dissatisfaction of the psychic being in the cosmic realm of things, in a lot of rational and humanistic circles today. It's being said that humans are just a cancer on the earth, and the earth would be better without it, and there's no, and this goes directly at the heart of that.
Yeah, true, absolutely. That sentence is so powerful. Our soul's dissatisfaction with imperfection as a law of life upon earth, its aspiration towards the elimination of all imperfections from our nature, not only in a heaven beyond, where it would be automatically impossible to be imperfect, but here and now, in a life where perfection has to be conquered by evolution and struggle, are as much a law of our being as that against which they revolt. They too are divine, a divine dissatisfaction, a divine aspiration. In the study of civilizations and cultural movements, it has been pointed out that there are two great impulses of society. One is the classical impulse and the other is the romantic impulse. And they pertain to these two philosophic views, the classical impulse to a world order that is perfect, and that in some sense is beyond the human, that may include the human and whatever the human does, but which ultimately overrides that. And the romantic view is that it is the, you know, the struggle of the human being which really gives meaning to, or the struggle of the entire creation, the human being being a certain, you know, spearhead of that movement, is what gives meaning to the creation. And in fact, the struggle is against the struggle for order. And the Greeks had a tragic view on this, because they felt that the struggle of the human was doomed never to achieve its perfection. It was really the asuras, in a sense, for the Greeks, that you know, titans like Prometheus and human heroes that tried to break the law of Zeus, but would never really succeed. This notion of the law, or, you know, Nietzsche sees it as the contest between Apollo and Dionysius. You know, this, on the one hand, something that gives this perfect harmony, you know, order, the order of the celestial spheres, and on the other hand, that which struggles and, you know, always tries to exceed whatever is given to it, is marked by divine discontent. This struggle is in itself one of the central themes of human existence. Whatever order we build, we struggle to destroy and rebuild.
Joanna, would you like to read next?
Okay. My birds have been a little noisy this morning. Right now they're quiet, but just a warning. In this light, we can admit that all works perfectly towards a divine end by a divine wisdom, and therefore each thing is in that sense perfectly fitted in its place. But we say that that is not the whole of the divine purpose. For what is only justifiable, finds its perfect sense and satisfaction by what can and will be. There is no doubt a key in the divine reason that would justify things as they are, by revealing their right significance and true secret as other, subtler, deeper than their outward meaning and phenomenal appearance, which is all that can normally be caught by our present intelligence. But we cannot be content with that belief. To search for and find the spiritual key of things is the law of our being. The sign of the finding is not a philosophical intellectual recognition and a resigned or sage acceptance of things as they are, because of some divine sense and purpose in them which is beyond us. The real sign is an elevation towards the spiritual knowledge and power which will transform the law and phenomena and external forms of our life nearer to a true image of that divine sense and purpose. It is right and reasonable to endure with equanimity, suffering, and subjection to defeat as the immediate will of God, a present law of imperfection laid on our members, but on condition that we recognize it also as the will of God in us to transcend evil and suffering, to transform imperfection into perfection, to rise into a higher law of divine nature. In our human consciousness, there is the image of an ideal truth of being, a divine nature, an incipient Godhead. In relation to that higher truth, our present state of imperfection can be relatively described as an undivine life, and the conditions of the world from which we start as undivine conditions. The imperfections are the indication given to us that they are there as first disguises, not as the intended expression of the divine being and the divine nature. It is a power within us, the concealed divinity, that has lit the flame of aspiration, pictures the image of the ideal, keeps alive our discontent, and pushes us to throw off the disguise and to reveal, or in the Vedic phrase, to form and disclose the Godhead in the manifest spirit, mind, life, and body of this terrestrial creature. Our present nature can only be transitional. Our imperfect status is starting point and opportunity for the achievement of another higher, wider, and greater that shall be divine and perfect, not only by the secret spirit within it, but in its manifest and most outward form of existence.
So here he's amplifying that idea, and he starts again with that notion of a divine order, and says that this order is not complete without the participation of the human psychic element, and that is what, you know, we have to develop in our own existence. So as he says, that it is not a philosophical intellectual recognition that we are called upon that to deploy, but this elevation towards the spiritual knowledge and power which will transform the law and phenomena and external forms of our life nearer to a true image of the divine sense and purpose. And then he brings to our attention this idea of the archetypal image, the divine image that is within us as a kind of a memory, and outside us as the truth, consciousness. In our human consciousness, there is the image of an ideal truth of being, a divine nature, an incipient Godhead. In relation to that higher truth, our present state of imperfection can be relatively described as an undivine life. The conditions of the world from which we start as undivine conditions. So this also shows us very clearly what is the meaning of the struggle. Well, what are we struggling for? Why is this world a world that is marked with struggle? Ultimately, this is the struggle, the sense. The center of the struggle is the struggle to release the divine truth and perfection from within the imperfection by the power of the soul and the relationship between the soul and the divine acting upon the nature. So this is the meaning of the creation and of the imperfection within the perfection. Now we find that the intuition of this divine and undivine is something that is seeded into the human life. And so from the very beginning of human times, there has been some kind of notion of the divine and the undivine. It also forms our ontological sense of verticality. In other words, that there is something towards which, something above, something towards which we have to aspire. Many cultures in their early stages didn't have the sense of verticality. Everything was flat for them. And there is a lot made about a certain stage in social development when there is the notion of the division of sky and earth, that there are two different things. Sky goes infinitely above and is held in place, doesn't fall down, is held in place by some invisible power. So that is the notion of the verticality, vertical dimension along which perfection must proceed. The scale from the undivine to the divine is drawn. And that is essentially what the struggle of yoga is all about. But we mistake that struggle for a variety of other things at the social level. And so, we were talking about Islam, for example, which has come into the limelight a lot nowadays. And we find that there are two very key, sort of pillars on which Islam is built. One of them is what we were just discussing, the very meaning of the term, which is submission, and which says that that there is a kind of an eternal duality between the divine and the human. All humans are the creatures of God, who is the creator. And we cannot ever fully know what God means with us or with the world. And so we must just submit ourselves to this merciful supreme power. This is one of the pillars, the primary pillar of Islam. And the second pillar of Islam is the struggle, which is called jihad. And this struggle is founded on the notion of the divine and the undivine, a sectioning of the entire universe, the cosmos as we experience it, into these two realms of the divine and the undivine. And the realm of the divine is the realm of peace, Dar al-Salam. And the realm of the undivine is the realm of struggle and war. It is Dar al-Harb. And so it becomes the job of the individual to, fight the war of jihad and release the war of the land of the undivine, so that it becomes the land of the divine. This is the whole idea. But social formulation of this has connected it to religious, identity. And that has created tremendous problems in the world. But basically the idea of the struggle leading to the establishment of the divine consciousness is one of the foundations of this, as with many other religious teachings, if you look at them from their deeper point of view.
I was thinking about the relationship. The struggle has its own relationship, but I'm not sure he's saying very much about the relationship between the human psychic ability and the rest of the creation. Because I guess I have a little discomfort with the with setting the psychic being of the human as above the the divine aspiration of the rest of the creation, of the one. And I'm not sure I'm seeing anything, at least maybe he says it, he talks about it later, but I haven't. Can you just say something about that?
Yes, Joanna. So, in this particular paragraph over here, he's addressing the human, and so that distinction is not very clearly made, but in the previous paragraph, if you noticed, he says, but there is an essential factor in our human consciousness and its workings, which no less than the reason distinguishes it entirely from the animal. There is not only a mental part in us which recognizes the imperfection, there is a psychic part which rejects it. So this psychic part which rejects it, he's using as a kind of a distinction between the human and the animal. Now, this is, of course, the treatment given is very sort of, in passing. But elsewhere where he has given a fuller treatment, and I think the mother has given even more full treatment to this aspect of the psychic and the human psychic, is, as I said, the kind of a quantum leap takes place in the formation of the psychic being in the human. So the idea is that the psychic element, or the psychic, the soul spark, as the mother calls it sometimes, is something which everything, every entity possesses it. And possessing it means that, everything is intrinsically divine. Within it, everything has the divine, element within it. And that divine element can express itself in the nature, to the extent that it can identify with the nature. So this evolution of the psychic element in the creation is something that gives it a certain form and control over the properties of ignorance that are manifest in the nature of the creatures. So that particular sort of attempt to form the psychic being reaches a certain stage in nature where, due to the presence of the full-blown capacity of reasoning in human beings, the psychic being also, or the psychic entity, also can shape itself into a more enduring presence with a greater freedom in it. You know, it comes more into its own, as it were, because it finds a nature instrument capable of a degree of freedom, which is what the human mind has, that allows it a certain, more that full-bodied existence. So the psychic being, the word the psychic being, is never used in Sri Aurobindo or the mother's literature for other creatures or animal creatures before the human. The psychic element is there, but the psychic being develops an enduring presence as something that has a crystallized form only at the human stage, according to their teaching.
Okay, thank you, Deb. She's, I think it's a, I still think that a lot of, I have to think about this some more, because I think there's a lot of relationship in the divine realm of the psychic element and the psychic being that has to be part of evolution.
Yeah, undoubtedly it is. And I mean, so if you're saying that animals are also evolving, of course they are evolving. And but this question of individuality, to what extent animals are individually kind of pushing, you know, their nature may be very developed. Some animals may have a highly developed nature in some sense. The psychic element is also trying to build a psychic being in those cases. And of course, the psychic being is not something that suddenly appears all of a sudden full-blown in the human. It goes through stages, and we may say that there are sort of, you know, that transition from whatever animal life to a human life for the soul is mediated by stages in the formation of the psychic being. So it couldn't be something which is entirely absent in one and completely present in another, but goes through certain kind of transforms. You know, this ability to, move towards full-blown, you see, the whole notion of a purusha, which chaitya purusha, a certain kind of a full-formed entity, conscious being, that can have individual form and experience the cosmos in an individual way, becomes a possibility, available to the human in the evolutionary march.
There's a sense, all of this, you know, surely that this is all true, and I certainly recognize all of that. But there's an element of the divine in, say, an animal, to which humans just may not have accessibility, just because we have our senses, they have their senses, and their sense of divine may be a different type of sense that humans are not privy to, just because we are different in that way. So the reason I think about this is because I think that the intuitions that we have allow us to access some of that other type of divineness that I conceive of as necessary to a full evolution, and that in our own development we can be open to different ways of accessing the divine elements in other beings, in other species, maybe even in rocks. If we could learn how to, it seems like it must be accessible in some way.
Yeah.
Certainly not through our senses.
Oh, of course, Joanna. That goes completely. I mean, that would naturally, if the divine is the only reality there is, then the divine is present in all these beings in a specific way and form. And it should be possible to contact those ways and forms of being of the divine as part of the knowledge by identity, which a divine consciousness can bring us. And so when we are talking about the human psychic being, that also is something which is a relative formation. The human psychic being brings us knowledge. It's also a question mark. I mean, we are talking about the kind of mode of existence of the divine as some other kind of creature in the human. What is that mode of existence? Is it a mode of existence different from other kinds of modes of existence of the divine? Or is it a capacity to unite with the primary substance of the divine that has become all these other things? That is the real question. So the question is, the point is that the human as it is constituted right now, and if we can talk of a human psychic, which is in some way different from the psychic element and other beings, other creatures, that would also be a kind of a limitation. It would be a species bound limitation. And this is one of the points that Sri Aurobindo is making, that the human being is not bound in such a way. That's why the definition of the human has to be kept open-ended. The human being can, aspire in such a way that it can, metamorphose, transform itself into other types of beings. And it's the psychic element ultimately is the changeling in us. That is what has become whatever there is. And ultimately that is what will take us beyond ourselves. To go beyond ourselves, we have to experience alterity. We have to be able to experience the other in its fullness. And that is part of the psychic journey at the human level as well.
This seems to go, this question seems to be very deep and endless.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like there's more.
Sure.
Thanks, Debashi.
In this, just during this discussion, I was thinking this kind of intriguing that it's the human human species has got these two aspects. One is that it's a mental, the much more developed mind is there as a mental being. At the same time, there's the one which has this psychic being. So there must be a reason why these two have been chosen in one.
I feel so too. I feel so. That's why I feel, the appearance of the mind in the human. See, this is, as you're saying, the relationship between Purusha and Prakriti is empowering to both of them. So that if the Prakriti develops certain capacities, it automatically allows Purusha to express new capacities. So if the mind has been developed in such a way that Purusha can experience a certain extra degree of freedom through the operation of the mind, then the psychic element can also take a new shape. Can take a shape which enjoys that freedom. And that is really the appearance of the psychic being. It now has the potential of the full capacity of the divine Purusha.
I mean, could it be said that just in this, as a following your comment, is that this ego, ego is also a shadow of individuality, right? And the psychic being is the seed of the real individuality. So this mental being, the mind, the development of the mind is sort of a, one big ingredient for this ego individuality. And that sort of builds the infrastructure of the real individuality. Of course, it doesn't easily give to it. But so basically what I mean is that this mind, the developed mind, is a good instrument of the ego individuality, whereas a psychic being is the real individual.
Yeah, that is also true. That property that the mind brings, which is the sense of self, the sense of individuality, the sense of also the power to reflect on the being and ask the question, "Who am I?" So the notion of individuality becomes conscious in the mind. The ego, there is an ego to the vital and the physical as well, but the mental ego is a ego of identity. It has a conscious sense of self, and that is related to the appearance of a kind of an enduring self in the psychic being. You know, so I completely agree. That is one of the sort of links between the mind and the psychic.
So shall we close for this week at this point and continue next time?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Thank you, Devashishta.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Devashishta.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Devashishta. Happy New Year, everybody.
Yeah, Happy New Year to all of you.
Thank you. Happy New Year.
Thank you to everybody.
Okay, bye.